Ford Motor Company today unveils the 2015 Mustang, one of Dearborn, Michigan's proudest creations. In part to mark the model's 50th anniversary. Now, the unveiling happened simultaneously in six cities around the world, including Dearborn, but also Los Angeles. Barcelona is one of them, several continents. It's the model's first upgrade since 2005. And it also includes the option of an EcoBoost engine, which, if memory serves, was not around in the 1960s. I mean, muscle cars just didn't have EcoBoost, four-cylinder EcoBoost engines, but the new 2015 Mustang does. Coming up later in the hour here on Current State, an animal rights organization is filing suit to give four captive chimpanzees human legal rights. We'll learn more from MSU College of Law's David Favor. But what say we continue our look back at the 1960s for a few minutes here with our next guest. Many in the Lansing area know Ling Brewer as a longtime Ingham County clerk, 1977 to 94, then as a three-term Democratic state representative. Brewer's also served as county commissioner and is an original founder of Impression 5 Museum. We can now add author to that list. In his new book, Dreams Gone Wrong, the Lansing native recounts how the complexities of the 1960s, the Vietnam War, local and national politics, drugs, and protest, played out dramatically right here in East Lansing and at Michigan State University. Ling Brewer graduated from MSU in 1968 and witnessed much of the drama about which he writes. Ling Brewer, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark. Happy to be here.
The 60s were eventful years here in East Lansing for those of us who were around, and your book covers a lot of ground. Can you give us a rough synopsis of Dreams Gone Wrong?
I sure can. It's Dreams Gone Wrong, Peace, War, and Murder at Michigan State University, and I'm happy to have you segue from the new Mustang into my book, because a lot of the book is set against a fantastic, perhaps once-in-a-millennium prosperity that the Oldsmobile manufacturing brought to the community. It was also, you know, you talk about something being turbocharged, and of course the economic stimulus that the war added to the already existing prosperity made things that much more prosperous. So the book is set against the background of prosperity, the background of the turbulent Vietnam War era, and the book is about some high-level, high-stakes gamblers that when they left the university for broader horizons, they found the world a lot more rough, a lot more intractable. And when John Hanna and the university administration involved themselves in the Vietnam War far beyond in any other university or entity in the country, they were involved from the very beginning. And with the best of intentions, they also found the world a lot more intractable and rougher.
Hence the title of the book, Dreams Gone Wrong.
Correct.
Now, is the book entirely nonfiction, or have you fictionalized any part of it?
The book is totally nonfiction and totally true. Did some cutting and pasting of various scenes, but it's absolutely accurate and true to the best of my ability.
Now, you got a number of colorful friends and acquaintances of yours. These are actual friends and acquaintances
These
of yours
are
from the
1960s? And acquaintances.
A few of whom are gamblers.
A few of whom are gamblers, and many of whom are dead, unfortunately.
Why do you include their stories?
Their stories, I think, there are so many stories relating to the war that are purely academic and purely ideological, and these people were pretty much non-political initially, and the war had an effect on them too. And I think the effect the war had on them was perhaps more typical than it was of the people that might have been more extreme or more political or more pure.
Mm. In marked contrast to your young gamblers and other friends, two key MSU figures are central to the book as well. Former MSU President John Hanna, for one, you've already mentioned him. Why is he a central figure in the book?
He's a central figure in the book because again, with the best of intentions, I don't have the background or the standing to assess his brilliance, his shrewdness as an administrator, as a builder of the university.
Mm-hmm.
That was just unparalleled, perhaps one in a million. But when he involved himself in Vietnam, with the best of intentions, he made a huge mistake. It affected the campus. It affected the country. And I think if there was going to be a Mount Rushmore of tragic figures that were related to the Vietnam War, I think he would be perhaps up there with JFK and Lyndon Johnson.
Did you follow President Hanna closely then while you were, you know, in the mid-60s?
I knew nothing of this in the mid-60s. I was clueless because I was a little political and I love my history, but it was not open knowledge about what was going on in Vietnam War. I think in academic circles it was known a little bit, but I don't think the average person. I talk to people today that are flabbergasted by what I tell them about the university.
And how many years did it take you to sort through the impact of John Hanna's involvement in Vietnam and the universities?
I started getting, read the infamous Ramparts article in 1966, but I went to grad school at Cal State, and Bob Sigliano, who was the assistant director of the MSUG there, and I had him for some courses, and we talked about it a bit.
MSUG, what's
that?
The
Michigan State University Group, which was the umbrella group that had university faculty, administrators, and especially police scientists that Arthur Brandstetter Sr. was the talent scout for, recruiting police experts from all over the country that worked under the MSU group that went to Vietnam, that a lot of it was non-police, designing the bureaucratic infrastructure, designing a constitution, but they were also responsible for designing the National Guard and the secret police, which went on to be a fundamental problem about the basic unworkability and artificiality of Ngo Dinh. They also created Ngo Dinh Diem, the first president. Wesley Fischel was involved in that.
What motivated, do you feel you know John Hanna well enough after all these years that you can explain his motivations? You referred to him earlier as a well-intentioned man. What drove this involvement in Vietnam? What drove this pursuit of activity in Vietnam?
Well, I think. Let me quote Milton Mulder, who worked with him for 20 years, who was a dean of social sciences and had the rank of vice president. And he said he thought John Hanna was much too enamored of the military and couldn't say no to them. He said he greatly respected Hanna, but when it came to his interactions with the military, he didn't trust him. And at the same time, John Hanna was president of the university. He was an assistant secretary of defense for manpower.
That's extraordinary. At the time he was MSU president, he was also an associate secretary of defense assistant?
Yes. Yeah. So I think he was a cold warrior. And
that explains a lot of it right there. It's a Cold War mentality, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It was. And superimposed on that was this terrific World War II optimism, where anything was possible. We'd saved the world, and now we were going to save Vietnam.
Now, how would you expect a friendly acquaintance of John Hanna's to respond to your portrayal of him in the book? Are you confident that they'd find it fair and accurate?
I would hope so. I'm not here to shoot Santa Claus. John Hanna, there's no way of getting around it. John Hanna did not leave the university under pleasant circumstances. I mean, perhaps he did, perhaps becoming, he left to become head of AID, Association for International Development, which also had a military component, which also allowed him to continue his anti-war stuff, his anti-communist efforts. But Hannah, he had that blind spot, and I can't believe, I mean, when a leader of his stature leaves a university, I think they want to be pelted with garlands of roses, not with rotten eggs, as he was. So I'm not saying he didn't leave of his own volition, but I would say that he perhaps wore out his welcome.
Is the book more about John Hanna than anyone else?
I wouldn't say so, no. I would say that it's about substantially about the murders and the way that developed against the war, against the background of the war. And I believe truly that, I mean, these individuals that were murdered, they had their own responsibility. But I believe a couple of them that I regard as near and dear, a guy named Bob Verplank and a guy named Larry Chappell. I think that if it wouldn't have been for the time, I'm not saying they would have ever donned white, you know, donned ties, wore a white shirt, and become members of the Rotary. But I think they might have, this road less traveled, they might have gone down it not at all or a little slower.
Well, let's link these murders that you're alluding to here to what we've talked about so far. You link President Hanna and the gamblers, presenting them both as confident, ready to engage the larger world, and then you make the point that when they get involved in life outside of East Lansing for the larger world, they found a rougher, more intractable place. How do these explain what these murders have to do with the story?
Well, the East Lansing was an enclave. From the very beginning, it was an enclave. And ironically, the prosperity of Olds manufacturing and the automobile was kind of the death of the concentrated city, so the automobile made it that much easier to remove to the suburbs, of which East Lansing was the first one. So it was, there was literally a wooden fence around the university in the beginning, you know, to separate it from this broader, perhaps more sinful, more whatever world. And that's part of it. So the guys in East Lansing, and East Lansing was peaceable. And John Hanna, for all his clashes with the anti-war and anti-protest, the anti-housing discrimination people, was really very civilized in the way he dealt with it. And in a way, that might have been misleading for the gamblers when they left, because they thought the rest of the world was as peaceful. And these people lurking in the shadows in Lansing and seeing the swagger and the over-the-top exuberance of, you know, it was a clash of cultures, the blue-collar Lansing versus white-collar East Lansing.
But who got murdered? Who are these people?
The people that were murdered, Rick Fowler was a person of immense gambling talents. If he was alive today, he probably could have gone to enter the poker tour and done very well. But Rick had swagger. He was athletic, a football player, a wrestler, bright, shrewd, amoral, I would say.
A friend of yours?
I wouldn't say so. Okay. I wouldn't say so. And I'll talk to you about why he wasn't after the show is over.
The show is over. You can tell us now.
But Rick had dreams of glory in the gambling world, and he also had swagger. And I saw that swagger, the East Lansing types, of which I was. I was a Lansing kid. I was a blue-collar kid. The East Lansing people didn't see that swagger, but I saw it a million miles away. And I saw Rick was going to get into trouble when he went into Lansing. It was just over the top. And he was bright, he was skilled, one of the best. He could cheat, he would cheat, he didn't need to cheat. And when he ran afoul a man named George Hall, who was a bit like a Hell's Angel, small A, Hell's Angel, an avenging angel. And he'd done 12 years for statutory rape for a girl he met in a bar, totally consensual, that he thought was 21, gotten in an argument with the judge. The sentence went from 6 to 8 to 10 to 12. He ended up serving 6. And after that, he got out and was an angry man, was looking for justice. and the clash between Rick had several clues. He got his arm broken in two places by a pool cue after he, you know, his swagger got over the top early before he met George. But when he left East Lansing for Lansing, he was, I think, almost destined to run into somebody like George, either George Hall or somebody like him.
It sounds like, is the book a coming-of-age book in a way? I mean, for university administrators and for common and for ordinary people.
I think that's
how you link them
together. I think
that's
a better way to put it than I could put it, Mark. I think that's exactly what it is. It's a coming-of-age book, and the age that they came up in was not a... not a typical age, and Carl Taylor was a black social prof, and so he had a foot both in the athletic world and the protest world. He called John Hanna a conventional man for a conventional time, and the time that John Hanna helped create was not conventional, and the effect that it had on the coming of age of these people like Verplank and Chapel and Fowler was didn't turn out well.
Have you wanted to write this book? Is this one of those situations where this book has been inside you since 1969 and you finally had the time to write it, or what?
I talked to Walter Adams' widow Pauline and a little bit about the book, and she said the story needed to be told about MSU's involvement in Vietnam. And by the way, Walter Adams, John Adams' time was past, and I think Walter Adams was the perfect man for the time, you know, after John Hanna left. But they said the story needed to be told, and I wanted to tell it. And my ex-wife, who didn't give me a lot of favors, said the same thing, you know, that the story needed to be told. And it had knocked around academic circles for a while, but was not widely known under a small circle. I wanted to do that, and truth be told, by talking about the murders, I thought more people were probably, and I wasn't particularly happy about writing about the murders of friends, but I thought that might entice people into reading more about the history of...
And learn more about the larger scene.
Yes.
There is a reception for Ling Brewer and his book scheduled for this afternoon, 2 p.m., Bigby Coffee on West Ottawa in downtown Lansing in the shadow of the House Office Building, where Ling Brewer served for a few terms. That is this afternoon at 2 at Bigby. Again, it's a fascinating account of lives in East Lansing and at Michigan State University, the greater Lansing area, in the very turbulent 60s, and how it played out here in East Lansing. The book is called Dreams Gone Wrong. Ling Brewer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Its current state on 90.5 WKAR. Researchers typically agree that humans and chimpanzees share a strong genetic link. However, a lawsuit filed this week is taking that connection a step further, arguing that chimpanzees should have the rights of a legal person. The Non-Human Rights Project has launched lawsuits on behalf of four chimpanzees. The chimps, Tommy, Kiko, Hercules, and Leo, are all privately owned and held in the state of New York. The activist group is seeking bodily liberty for the chimpanzees and asking that they be moved to a sanctuary. David Favor is an animal law expert and a professor at Michigan State University's College of Law. He joins us now to break down this unprecedented lawsuit. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
The Non-Human Rights Project is the group that's filing these suits. Tell us about the organization.
Organization is relatively new, and it's very narrow in its focus. It's not like a lot of the other animal groups you might have heard of, in that its sole purpose is to file these lawsuits that will raise the issue of the standing of animals in the legal system.
Now, the legal cause of action that the Non-Human Rights Project is citing is the common law writ of habeas corpus. We've all heard of that. Remind us what habeas corpus is.
Habeas corpus means that somebody is holding another individual without proper legal authority.
And the case that the Non-Human Rights Project is basing this on, there is a precedent in their view anyway, and this is a case that dates back to slave days, the Somerset case. Tell us how that plays into this.
Ah, well, the Somerset case was a case in England in which habeas corpus was used to free a slave that had come from the United States with its master, and the judicial system within England ultimately held, I think it was Lord Mansfield, held that he could not be a slave on British soil and therefore was a person and deserved the attention of the legal system.
So habeas corpus applies to humans, but this group's position is that it also should be applicable to animals.
Right. And the transition point in that is the word person, in that the word person in the legal system, legal person, is not necessarily synonymous with the word human being. And therefore, the flexibility of that word is available to the legal system to expand it to include chimpanzees.
And are there examples of things that have legal personhood?
Yes. Cities have legal personhood. Corporations have legal personhood. Ships have legal personhood.
How about that? It's an interesting use of the word. How much of
right.
this is semantic?
Well, if you're a lawyer, it's all understood, but the general public gets a little confused sometimes, yes.
All of the chimps involved in this case are in the state of New York. Why is that?
Because it's a state lawsuit, and they have found all of the privately owned chimps, I think, in the state of New York. So they're sort of doing a small class action for chimpanzees in New York. And they've chosen New York as the focal point because it needs to be a state law that is still under common law concepts. This is not a federal case at all. They made a choice of which one of the 50 states would be most congenial from a legal point of view to bring this case to re-examine what the word person means.
And chimpanzees occupy a unique place in the tree of life, I guess, if you will. Tell us about the unique qualities of chimpanzees that makes them the center of this case.
Well, there are cousins genetically that we are not descended from chimpanzees. We co-evolved from a prior species, but they are our cousins. And if I've had the opportunity to meet a chimpanzee that used sign language, and there was a conversation between us, she wanted to see my shoes. It was a typical four-year-old conversation the chimpanzee and I had. And I think that it goes to the issue of these chimpanzees have such mental capacities, awareness, language skills, that they deserve to have at least the recognition level that a child might get within the court system.
What do you think the chances are that the Non-Human Rights Project will prevail in this?
I think they have a shot at it. I think it is a legitimate. I think the judges will perceive this as a serious legal question, and therefore will treat it as such. Now, whether or not they ultimately resolve this one case, this one set of cases or not, I don't know. But they have a good chance at it, and it won't be the last one they file.
This is new legal territory, though. How groundbreaking
Absolutely.
Is this suit?
I think it is the first major legal suit I'm aware of in the world that will challenge the status of animals in the legal system.
David Favors, an animal law expert and professor at MSU's College of Law. Here we're talking about the lawsuit filed by the Non-Human Rights Project to try to enhance the rights of four chimpanzees in the state of New York. The short-term goal in this seems clear, remove the chimps from captivity, but is there a larger significance of giving animals legal personhood?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, and the filer of the lawsuit is well aware that this is a test case. They have a duality in what they're doing. They want to help those four chimpanzees, but they want to establish legal precedent, but then allow that door, once it's open, to be used in other circumstances.
Now, on their website, the Non-Human Project stated goal is to, and I'll quote, breach the legal wall that separates all humans from all non-human animals. If that's the case, why not file the suit on behalf of all animals? Why are they selecting chimpanzees?
You can't file a lawsuit on behalf of all animals. That's not a real legalistic approach. That's a sort of a PR idea. But you have to have a particular individual to file a lawsuit.
It's not a class action lawsuit?
That would bring other whole layers of complexity. He really has narrowed it down to a very specific focus for animals that are of almost equal level of intellectual capability.
Now, the non-human project has stated they plan to file more lawsuits for many different types of animals beyond trying to win this immediate case. What else does the project gain by taking many different cases to court?
They're seeking to then, they're hoping to crack the door open, give chimpanzee status, and then to expand that to engage other animals that are also deserving of consideration.
Did you see this evolving in your capacity as someone involved in the law? Did you anticipate a lawsuit like this at some point?
Well, I did have personal knowledge. I've been 30 years a friend of Steve Wise, who's the chair of this. So I knew, 8 years ago, he created this organization and dedicated it towards this activity. So I've been aware of it for a long time, yes.
And did that make your encounter with the chimpanzee possible, your acquaintance with Mr. Wise?
No, that was a parallel activity I was doing, yes.
Okay. And when will this be decided? How long will this take to decide?
This could take, it depends on what the defendants do. If they gather the resources to fight this at a true battle of legal, it could take well over a year because it's going to go to the Supreme Court of the state. But if they decide they don't want to fight the battle for the principle, then it may be over in 6 months.
And what kind of resistance do you expect them to encounter here? What kind of case will be made against them?
Well, the case against them will be that chimpanzees are not persons and have not been persons and shouldn't be allowed to be persons.
But who will make that case?
Well, that's what we don't know. Will a major organization step forward and do the legal front work that needs to be done to make this a major conflict in the courts? Or will the defendant simply give up and surrender their chimpanzees? We don't know what's going to happen.
Really intriguing. David Faber, thank you very much. David's an animal law expert and professor at Michigan State University's College of Law. We've been talking about the lawsuit filed this week that arguing that chimpanzees should have the rights of a legal person. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. What do we know about George Frideric Handel? He wrote The Messiah.
Radio host Carl Haas, who would have turned 100 this December 6th, a familiar voice for many who ever listened to the great voice of the Great Lakes and a number of other radio stations. WKAR's Melissa Benmark joins us right now to tell us about the life of Carl Haas.
Well, he had quite a number of accomplishments. That's him playing the piano, actually, at the beginning
that,
there.
Years ago, I heard that he played the intro live every day. Now, I don't know for all those years if that was true or not.
But. I don't. I would have asked his son, Jeff Haas, if I had heard about that. But not only was he a musician, people mostly know him for hosting Adventures in Good Music for 44 years. First, it was on WJR in Detroit. Later, it was in syndication. When I first started in public radio in 87, we were playing it up on CMU Public Radio. And his son, Jeff Haas, really shared his dad's passion for the music. But Jeff's path was a little different. He found his home in jazz. And the Jeff Haas Quintet is coming to Wharton Center this Sunday afternoon with a celebration of Carl Haas's life and work. And I talked with him a couple days ago over a very nice phone line, as a matter of fact, about his dad and the music and the tribute concert coming up.
So much of who I am and what I know as a result of my father's influence. He was my first piano teacher as a five-year-old. He taught me a lot about the piano and a lot about music. And even prior to that, my earliest recollections are sort of teetering around the organ loft in in Temple Israel in Detroit, where my father was an organist and music director for 25 years. So my life was filled with music from a very young age. And for the most part, I loved it. I mean, we led a modest lifestyle for the times, but we were raised in a really culturally rich environment. My parents started the Chamber Music Society of Detroit back in the 40s, and my other early recollections are crawling around the house listening to rehearsals of the first chair members of the Detroit Symphony joining my father for chamber music concerts. And by the time I was, five or six, Melissa, I was proudly learning the music so I could turn the pages for each of the individual instruments during the rehearsals. I probably knew more about the Schubert Trout Quintet than I did, the Detroit Tigers at that point in my life. And as I grew into my teen years, I began to explore different kinds of music. I share with you that my father was very, very strict and didn't allow anything but classical music in the home. In fact, he told us at a young age that rock and roll would ruin the needle on his stereo. And believed him, unfortunately.
he didn't necessarily mean that metaphorically, huh?
No, he meant it literally, for sure. And I was also a socially sort of awkward kid. I found haven at the piano at a very young age. So I didn't have a lot of friends, and I didn't do a lot outside of school other than go home and practice. So it was into my early teens before I even realized that there was other kinds of music that I would like. You know, after I developed my passion for jazz as a teenager, and that, by the way, got started because I found a copy of Monk and Coltrane live at the Five Spot hidden underneath my sister's mattress.
Oh, my. Contraband.
That was the contraband, yep. And I might add that I wasn't necessarily looking for LPs under my sister's mattress, but nonetheless, that's where I came upon my first jazz recording. But years later, after I had developed more as a jazz musician and just felt it was my home, it was where I belonged, I remember saying to my dad, I remember bringing him an Oscar Peterson recording, an LP, as I thought to myself, who could I introduce to my father that would bridge the gap between classical and jazz? And Oscar Peterson had a mutual admiration society going with Vladimir Horowitz and Arthur Rubinstein. They went to one another's concerts. So I mentioned that to my dad and said, you know, please check this out. This is the music that really turns me on. This is my passion, just like classical music is your passion. And it was probably 15 years later when I helped move him from one residence to another. I was packing up his record collection and found that copy of the Oscar Peterson album still sealed.
Oh, gosh.
So I went to my dad and said, Dad, why didn't you check this music out? It means so much to me. And he smiled, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he looked into my eyes and said with all sincerity, never forget this, if I spend the rest of my life studying classical music, I still won't get to everything that it is I want to learn about the music, the art form. And, you know, in that moment, I said to myself, you can't fault someone for that level of dedication and focus.
That's interesting because I can imagine that could have been kind of a painful and maybe even kind of a bitter moment.
Well, I suppose it could have been. It really warmed my heart to hear his perspective. And while I would have liked, you know, more interest in my career and the art form that meant so much to me, it did happen later on. As he aged, he spent time in Traverse City visiting with us on an annual basis. He was up in Traverse City for a week every summer, and he would come to a couple of my gigs, and I would see him in the corner. He would take his glasses off, and I would hear from my friends who were sitting with him that he would tell them to be quiet because he wanted to listen to the music.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah. And my father's philosophy all our lives was music is to be respected. He thought there was no such thing as background music.
Mm-hmm.
Either you're listening to it or you don't have it on.
Right, right.
It warranted that level of respect and attention.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is that people maybe our age and older have heard the term good music used as shorthand for classical music. And, of course, your father's program was Adventures in Good Music.
You know, maybe with a little bit of the implication that other kinds of music are maybe not as good. And you share your father's passion for music, but you chose the path of jazz with a lot of different influences in it. So in your mind now, what to you defines good music?
Well, I guess the way I would answer that, Melissa, is music that's played with passion, regardless of, you know, what genre it comes from, what category you'd put it in. Good music for me is music that is played with passion and with love. Music's all about sending love into the universe. You know, I believe that is the collective responsibility of musicians the world over. My father told me every day of my young life, music can heal the world. It was a very, very interesting and positive relationship for the most part. I think that the fact that we were both so passionate about our respective art forms only enhanced our respect and love for one another, even though he didn't participate directly in my appreciation, my love, my passion for jazz.
Right. So this concert is a celebration of what would have been your dad's 100th birthday. I guess you lost him about 8 years ago, is that right?
Yep, in 2005.
Okay. Can I ask what kind of music he liked to listen to the most toward the end of his life? What composers or what pieces?
Well, Beethoven was his main man. He used to tell me that he listened to, his mother was an amateur pianist back in southern Germany, and she used to play Beethoven sonatas for him as he sat at her feet at the piano. He fell in love with Beethoven, and that was his main compositional interest all his life. From a personal standpoint, I even remember my mom and dad sitting on the couch in the evening listening to Beethoven sonatas played by Arthur Schnabel, my father's teacher, holding hands and smiling at one another. Later on in his life, when he was dealing with some aging issues and some memory issues and so forth, I would sit on the couch with him and we'd listen to music, and he was no longer able to articulate about the music, verbally articulate about it, but he would hold my hand and squeeze my hand, and moments later, like seconds later after he squeezed my hand, there'd be a tempo modulation, there'd be a key signature modulation, there'd be a change in the music, something that he would have excitedly talked about. He was no longer able to do that, but he still recognized it in the music.
He was giving you kind of the tour of when this was going to happen by squeezing
yep.
your hand.
Yeah, and that's, when he visited me in Traverse City, we'd walk the beaches of Lake Michigan, which he just loved, and that's what he would talk about, the modulation of the Bach Italian Concerto from E-flat to F major, and how it impacted the music and so on and so forth. The guy was just totally passionate about it, and, the beauty of it is that his passion just jumped out at you through the airwaves, and as a result, he engaged people of all walks of life, all backgrounds, all interests in this music that was sort of looked upon as highbrow and sophisticated, and you can't appreciate it unless you are knowledgeable about it. I found a fan letter from a farmer in Nebraska that my dad had saved, and the fellow said, I listen to you every day on my transistor radio in the barn while I'm doing my chores. I don't have a clue what you're talking about, but I love the way you say it.
That is really a great, great letter.
Isn't it?
That's
Isn't
really
it?
Great.
So the celebration of his 100th birthday will be a broad variety of music. You will hear Beethoven, you will hear Mendelssohn, you will hear Thelonious Monk, you will hear Irving Berlin, you'll hear lots of my original music, which I've been composing for most of my adult life. My music is a blend of my passions, which are jazz and rhythm and blues and classical music and ethnic music. We'll play some of our old favorites of my original music. In fact, I've had a few requests from people in the Lansing area, so we'll be playing Polly's Pride and Cirrus. And we'll also be playing some new music that I wrote especially for this occasion. And I got to say, it's been a bit of an emotional roller coaster preparing for these concerts.
I bet, yeah.
One minute I'm laughing heartily, the next minute I'm holding back the tears.
Jeff Haas, we thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
What does holding hands mean in America? That may seem like a silly question, but for many international students across the country, it's a serious one. Trying to understand another country's customs is difficult, but a new guide is hoping to provide some basic cultural understanding for international students. 100 Questions and Answers About Americans was written over the past semester by MSU journalism students. The book addresses topics like religion, education, social behavior, and slang. And joining us now to discuss the book is Marinda Valley, an MSU journalism student who worked on the guide. Welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much for having me.
This book is part of a larger series that focuses on cultural competence. Give us an overview of this series and its purpose.
The series of the guide is really to make anyone who has questions about other cultures, religions eventually, and ethnicities. It's to make them feel comfortable and give them answers and ideas about starting dialogue with one another. So it's really to foster understanding. I think that what lies behind the technical term of cultural competence is just open-mindedness. And if you're willing to learn about people who are different from yourself, you can learn about them and
have a better experience if
yes.
you're in it from another country.
Yes.
Yeah. How were the questions compiled for the book?
For this book, we did a little bit of planning initially, and then all of the students in the class went out and interviewed international students. We found them in different ways. We tried to be judicious and go to different events that we knew would have international students, so we weren't just picking people out of a crowd and making assumptions about who they were, but we asked them about their experience coming to the United States, the perceptions that they had before they came here, and anything that they would want to tell maybe their former selves or tell other international students who have not gotten here yet.
And once you had broken the ice with these international students, was it easy to get them to suggest questions? And
that definitely varied based on who you talked to. I talked to a lot of international students who were friends of mine, but I also talked to people who I had just met at, as like I mentioned, events at like International Student Coffee Hour. So it just depended on who you were talking to, but you have to call in your journalistic skills and get people to open up.
Now, the questions you compiled were assembled into several different categories. What were some of those categories?
They range from race to work and money, culture, health, food and family, a lot of different things were addressed in the guide.
So tell us here, you've got the book in front of you. Tell us, what does holding hands mean in America? I can't wait to hear the answer.
We answer this question by saying, this usually means that the people have romantic involvement unless it is an adult holding a child's hand. Americans tend not to hold hands or link arms with friends or relatives as people in some cultures do. And some Americans also hold hands for comfort when frightened. So we tried to give kind of a broad range of answers for
possible
them. Yes.
Possible interpretations. Now, how did you compile the answers? Did some questions really require a lot more thought and research? I would imagine some did.
Definitely. We started out with a list much longer than the 100 questions that actually ended up in this guide, and we did a lot of editing, and we cut several questions and changed things, you know, from the way that we had originally written them down. So not all of these were given to us directly by the international students whom we interviewed. Some we created ourselves from what they had told us.
We're talking with Marinda Valley. Marinda is an MSU journalism student who participated in the creation of a book, 100 Questions and Answers About Americans, and this is for international students coming to the United States so they can get a better handle on what we are all about and what our culture is all about. The way this was put together is really fascinating. Your journalism class compiled this book in just 70 days.
That's right.
The whole thing, 100 questions, 100 answers, 70 days. Talk to us about that process.
It was very swift, to say the least.
It was a lot of work?
It was, but we did it in manageable stages. So we did quick planning, and then we went out and conducted our interviews with international students. And after that, it was just a lot of editing once we had written the questions down. So We had to do everything, like I said, really quickly, and we didn't have much time to go back. So
was it a class project? I assume it was.
Yes, okay. And we divided ourselves into different groups. We had a marketing team, an editing team, and also a visuals team, which created some videos for the book. But
how many countries are represented? I mean, students from how many countries did you establish contact with?
I don't know the exact number, but we talked to students from every continent, I believe, besides, I think, actually, we did speak to someone from North America, too, so almost every continent, and, you know, people from more than...
In the dozens? Dozens of different countries?
Definitely, okay. Dozens, yes.
Okay. What was the? Was there a question that you heard more often than anyone else?
Yes, one that came up frequently was... just how to make friends with American students. And a lot of people had that question.
I'm curious. You've got the book in front of you. Why don't you read us the answer there? How do you make friends with American students was the question?
Yes. How do I make American friends? And we said, take the first step by introducing yourself. To build relationships, it is important to connect with the person. In America, that means finding something in common to talk about or do together. Start a conversation with a person to get to know them, work in an organization or on a team or in a class project that can give you a shared interest and something in common.
Has this, has your experience in this, Marinda, has this changed your understanding of American culture? Did you end up learning more than you may have realized?
I learned several things, but I think the most surprising thing that I learned was related to this idea of being unaware about making American friends, because a lot of the people who told me that they were concerned about starting relationships with Americans were actually my friends who are international students. And when I met them, they were outgoing and weren't any different from my American friends. So,
Have you always extended yourself, made yourself available to international students? Do you feel like that's just the way you've gone about being a student at Michigan State University?
I think so. That's one reason that I came to Michigan State, because it is such a large and diverse place. So that probably helps me make friends of different backgrounds.
How have, has the book been finished long enough that a lot of the international students have had a chance to look at it? Have you gotten any feedback to the book?
Not yet. We're actually having a launch party for a book at International Student Coffee Hour this Friday. So we hope to give these books to students whom we interviewed and also others who are interested in it and speak to them about their interpretation of the book.
I noticed one of the other questions in the book was, what's included in a date?
Yes, that is...
Tell us how you answered that one.
We said dating is very casual and informal in the United States. People spend time together and don't even need to call it a date. Socially, a date can be anything you both want to do. It could mean dinner, an event or entertainment, or just a walk to get ice cream. People can also get to know each other in larger groups where no one is paired off with anyone else.
Hmm. Did you find in your experience from this that there were students from some other countries that just have an easier time of acclimating to the United States?
Yes, definitely. And that's one of the challenges in creating a book like this, is because while you want to steer people away from generalizations that they might have about Americans, you also have to answer questions oftentimes with broad statements. So, you know, no one's experience is the same. Someone from Bangladesh isn't going to have the same experience here as someone from Canada. So we did our best to address that.
Are there general perceptions of Americans that the international students have that cross countries' boundaries? Are there common ones like that?
Yeah, I guess I would say that overall, international students feel that Americans are kind of contained within their own country. So in terms of cultural awareness, or just as we were talking about, the willingness to step outside of their own
comfort zone or their own context.
Yes.
We're talking with Marinda Valley, who's an MSU journalism student who was a key player in the creation of the book 100 Questions and Answers About Americans. This is for international students attending Michigan State University. Where are you looking to distribute the book?
We are going to be giving out about 100 or more copies at our launch event this Friday, but after that we are going to be sending sample copies to universities with high concentrations of international students across the country, and hopefully they'll be interested in using this for different programs at their universities. But we also have the book available on every platform through the innovative software from our publisher, Read the Spirit Book. So it's available right now for Kindle, Nook, iPad, everything. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Mm-hmm.
And you are, you're a journalism student at MSU. What kind of work do you want to be doing in 5 or 10 years?
I hope to be doing international reporting in the sense of foreign correspondence. So
pretty ambitious, pretty exciting line of work. Where would you like to report?
I would love to report in the South Pacific, but right now I'm, I guess, grooming myself to report in the Middle East because I'm studying Arabic. And
oh, how commendable. That's fantastic. How many people worked on the book altogether?
About 20 people did.
Okay.
But we also had, outside of our classroom, people who vetted the guide, so different experts about international relations, people from the Office of International Students and Scholars here at MSU, just to check our work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we want to thank you for joining us here on Current State, Marinda. Marinda Valley's an MSU journalism student. She is a participant in the creation of 100 Questions and Answers About Americans, geared toward international students acclimating to life at U.S. universities. Thanks, Marinda. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
That is our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, St. Mary's Cathedral in Lansing is celebrating its 100th anniversary. We take a look through the church's history. We also have live jazz tomorrow on Current State. We hope you can join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Barry, and Scott Pohl, as well as to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriela Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.